Knowledge, the great purifier, is a topic we are considering. We are considering this topic in the context of the natural aspiration of the human heart to obtain spiritual knowledge and to progress spiritually, to seek out the eternal. This is natural to human heart. Many devotees, not today, from time immemorial, have had this aspiration to reach to the source of one's self, to one's own true self. But one who aspires to the spiritual knowledge encounters great difficulties. It is not that one begins to aspire and one attains immediately. His aspiration begins in some life. He encounters great difficulty. Difficulties coming from his own self, from his own ignorance, from his own conditions in which he is surrounded. One of the first difficulties that he encounters is, who is the guide? Where is knowledge? And this confusion is made worse confounded when so many philosophies are there, so many doctrines are advanced, so many systems of spiritual discipline are offered, and there are many teachers who claim to be guides, they apparently seek to lead the aspirants to their aspire for. So what happens is there's confusion and one does not know which philosophy one should pursue and which discipline to accept and which teacher to follow and so on. Now I'll give you one example. As I already said, this confusion has always been there from very ancient times. Now there's one school of even today, there's one school from very ancient times persisting even today who believe that renouncing the world and doing nothing will, renouncing all actions and doing nothing will take them to the supreme goal. That kind of a notion and that kind of a practice has been there from very long time and till current today. And then there is another kind of devotees who think that the purification of body and mind and soul takes place and supreme goal of union with spirit, Brahman, is attained by mortifying the body. They subject the body to all kinds of tortures. Now if you read the Light of Asia, you see that Buddha encounters, in his search for truth, he encounters many of such devotees who have been macerating their senses and organs in a most brutal way. And when he questioned why you are doing this, they said this is the way to eternal absorption. And they don't listen to him. My brothers, this will not lead you to self-purification and attainment of nirvana. But such is the obduracy of human bias and false thinking that even Buddha was unable to convince them. Let's see how beautifully this is stated in the Light of the Path. When Buddha asked, why are you doing this, macerating your body in such dreadful manner? And the devotee says, it is written, if a man shall mortify his flesh till pain be grown the life he lives and death voluptuous rest, such woes shall purge sins draws away, and the soul purified soar from the furnace of its sorrow winged for glorious spheres and splendors past all thought. And then he goes on to say, substantiating his belief and his school of thought, and we hate this accursed body, accursed flesh, which clogs the that fain would rise. So for the sake of soul, we stake brief agonies in game with gods to gain the larger joys. So subject oneself to terrible self-torture and maiming the senses and organs, thinking that these senses and organs are the tempters and they lead us into error, and hope thereby to attain to sphere of the gods, to enjoy the divine felicity in higher regions and ultimately attain nirvana. Buddha says, no, even if you attain to higher sphere of the god, which is not possible with this kind of a self-torture, but even if you were to attain to such heights of the realms of the gods, even the gods are temporary, even they will die. Even Brahma does not persist. One day he has a beginning and he has an end. This is not the way of truth, and you will have to return again to the same self-torture. Don't listen to him at all. So even today you have such devotees who practice severe self-purification, and in the Bhagavad Gita you have Krishna saying that this is not the path, and Buddha has always taught this is not the path. Krishna says these devotees who torture themselves torture me also, who am in that bodies. In spite of all these kinds of different schools persist. Teachers come again and again. Whenever they come, they review all the schools of thought and disciplines, and then separate chaff from the grain in the light of the revived spiritual knowledge they impart. And yet, the errors persist. And you have today Hatha Yoga practices. How many people, thousands and thousands, they think by blocking up the channels of inspiration and expiration and suppressing breath in breath, pranayama, and assuming all sorts of contortions of the body called yogasana, you will be able to attain to spiritual heights. This is folly. How this is folly, we will see presently. In spite of all this, true knowledge has always been there from remotest antiquities to this day. True teachers are there. True teachings are there. Without any ambiguity, clear. It's all there. Even in the exoteric scriptures you will find this. For instance, one true knowledge, one royal road, Krishna speaks of in the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, kingly science and the kingly mystery. He's imparting to Arjuna because he was qualified for that. Only thing is, if we also qualify for that, then we will be entitled to receive such a knowledge from those who know. But how do we qualify it? That is, how we can qualify for that. And then Buddha also taught the same thing. The whole of Dhammapada is has two purposes. One to show how these practices, many of the false practices, will not lead you anywhere. And then what is the true way? All the great teachers serve two purposes. They're iconoclasts and then again rebuilders. They destroy the wrong ideas, wrong practices with their higher knowledge. And then in the place of the demolished dogmas and wrong ideas and conceptions and systems and disciplines, they show the true way, the true philosophy, the true knowledge. And such was the time when Theosophical Movement was launched in 1875, when the old ancient wisdom was once again promulgated by the great masters of wisdom through their messengers. And we have today even that. In spite of it, should people persist? There's a great, really, there's a great wonder. Now, as already said, read from the Bhagavad Gita, there are many practices. And Sri Krishna reviews them and then shows that they are insufficient. And after showing they are insufficient, he he shows what is the true way. Just consider this. Repeat what I read in the beginning. Some devotees give sacrifice to the gods, while others letting the subtle fire of the Supreme Spirit offer up themselves. Still others make sacrifice with senses, beginning with hearing in the fire of self-restraint. And some give up all sense-delighting sounds, and others again, illuminated by spiritual knowledge, sacrifice all the functions of the senses and vitality in the fire of devotion constraint. There are also those who perform sacrifice by wealth given in alms, by mortification, that is tapas, by devotion and by silent study. Some sacrifice the upbreathing in the downbreathing, and downbreathing in the upbreathing, and by blocking up the channels of inspiration and expiration, and others by stopping the movements of both life breaths. Still others by abstaining from food sacrifice life in their life. These are all various kinds of Hatha Yoga practices. There are various kinds of Hatha Yoga practices. Now, what does Krishna say to all this? He says, in all these practices, some purification takes place. Some purification takes place, but not the amount needed for real spiritual knowledge. And how does the real spiritual knowledge comes? Look what he says. All these different kinds, I quote, all these different kinds of worshippers are by their sacrifices fired from their sins. But they who partake of the perfection of spiritual knowledge arising from such sacrifice pass into the eternal Supreme Spirit. So he's speaking of the perfection of spiritual knowledge arising from sacrifice. Now the question is, the point is, Krishna here pointing out the true way. That is, there is a kind of sacrifice which leads to perfection of spiritual knowledge. There's a kind of sacrifice which leads to perfection of spiritual knowledge. And he has made it very plain what that sacrifice is and what the practice is. We'll come to that again shortly. Now, the question is, what is sacrifice? That is the important point. Now, we can never have any clear idea about the path that one has to, in order to reach the perfection of spiritual knowledge Krishna is speaking of, unless and until we have a very clear idea through philosophic study, of the study of the true teachings of the masters of wisdom regarding the nature of the true self, what our true nature is. That is the most important thing. After having ascertained what the nature of the true self is, then we have to discriminate between what is true self and what is not self. It's only through such discrimination and differentiation and always abiding in what is true and real, our understanding of the true self, and gradually and step by step, through long practice, through discrimination, dissociate ourselves from our wrong idea of not self to be the self. Body, circumstances, mind, desires, our likes and dislikes, to be the I, to be the self. So first, knowledge of the true self has to be obtained, and then with that intuitive knowledge, with that knowledge gained through long study, reflection and meditation, though you haven't realized it, but you are convinced of it, and with that conviction, see and discriminate, and at every step, in every moment of your life, in every experience that comes to us, see what is self and what is not self, and abide in the self, true self, and renounce inwardly what is not the self. The personality of name and form, that which we call I and mine, is not the true self. This we can ascertain if we meditate reflect and meditate upon the nature of the self. We see that we talk of all these experiences, the sensations, the desires, the thoughts, these ideas, ideals, in a possessive way. But who is the one who is possessor? The perceiver, the consciousness itself, the self, in a little reflection, without any elaborate metaphysics, we can ascertain inwardly that self stands apart from and essentially uncontaminated and unsullied by many of the experiences that we go through. Just like in a dream, we see the dream, we seem to be involved in the dream, but we all know that we have nothing to do with dream. We only created those dreams by our impressions of our waking experiences and seeing it getting involved through ignorance. And in reality, we are not the dream experiences. In a similar way, we must discover it in the waking life. This we have to, the first step that we have to do in order to arrive at the nature of the true self. Now, if the self is changeless, it has to be changeless, because change cannot perceive change. We see we have been undergoing changes right from our birth to the present day. So many innumerable changes have occurred in our body, in our ideas, in our beliefs, in our emotions, ideals, and so on and so forth. But there is something in us which remains unchanged, and noting all these changes, and that perceiver is changeless. Reflect on this axiom: change cannot perceive change, only changeless can perceive change. So we are the changeless, eternal self who is the witness, the innumerable experiences that the self is witness to, is going through. So hold on to that idea. If self is unchanging, then it is eternal. Then it has neither birth nor death. It has neither beginning nor end. It is there, it was there before the body came. It persists unchanged during all the experiences that we are going, and it will never perish where the body perishes. So if it is eternal, then it is universal. If that is true of me, it is true of every other person. So everyone, every being is the true self. So which means universal brotherhood. So which substantiates this reflection, substantiate the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita, that just as one sun illuminates the whole world, so does one spirit illuminate all bodies. So what does it mean, universal brotherhood? Which means that though we see separateness, I and mine and you and I, and we see so many differences, out of ignorance of the nature of the true self, the fact remains that true self is one, not many. The one and the same self is in me, in you, in all. So such that we live in others, others live in us, and we profoundly affect each other, and all the diverse beings or so many manifestations of one single self are invariably interconnected, interdependent, and affect each other profoundly, and all are heading towards the source from which they all emanated. There is one progressive march of all beings, whole of nature, towards a higher life. And if we act in a way that is contrary to the fact of universal brotherhood, to the fact of oneself pervading all, to the fact that the sense of separateness is only illusionary appearance, not true, and if we act with a notion that we are separate and act from the point of view of separateness, we invariably bring about a disharmony in the in the relationship by which all are bound together and all are heading towards a higher life, and we'll be obstructing this progressive order. So invariably it brings on suffering to us and more ignorance into our minds. So this we must recognize. So what happens is that we generate karma. Whenever we act of separateness, it is natural to us at this stage of our evolution, because we as spiritual beings have descended into matter for a great purpose, and for a time we are become deluded and become become identified falsely with what is not self. And it is our destiny, it is our purpose in life to disentangle our minds through discriminative knowledge from this error and restore, even well in the body, the knowledge of the true self, realization of the true self, even while living the body. There is a purpose for which we all are here on this earth, in this body. And all the lessons that we are undergoing in life has this as the ultimate end, to teach us. Why does pain and sorrow come to us? Pain and sorrow come to us to tell us that what pain and hurt has come from your violation of the laws of life, and to remind us that this is not the way, go this way. So they come as lessons to us. So when we act contrary to the reality, contrary to the nature of the true nature of things and nature of self, we bring on suffering. And through this suffering alone, we learn lessons and come to knowledge. That's why, you know, it's only the immense suffering that comes to us through wrong thinking and wrong acting ultimately wakens us up in search of truth. That's why Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that out of the four worshippers, the first one is one who suffers and is the one, artha, one who is suffering. And he seeks for possession of spiritual knowledge. So this is the purpose of life. So when we act from the basis of sense of separateness, then it out of ignorance, and this ignorance is called avidya. Avidya means mistaking the self to be non-self, and by that every other mistake and error occurs. And out of that avidya comes egotism, I. Egotism is the worst enemy of man. You know, from egotism arises attachment. From attachment arises desire. From desire comes anger. From anger comes hatred, revenge, jealousy, and a brood of multitudinous evils that torment us. And where does the evil, all this emanate from, come from? Not outside, no other agency. It's our own mistaken notion acting in the wrong direction, in the wrong way. It brings us suffering. So it is, what has happened is we have generated so many causes, none of which is ever destroyed, none of which is ever obliterated, but remains as potential causes, which brings about rebirth again and again. In every rebirth, we bring to us all the defects of character that we have had built up by our past actions. We come into this again, as well as to enjoy whatever good fruits that we had done earlier. So unless and until this attachment to wrong things, to wrong ideas, are destroyed through knowledge, there is no way by which we can be free from, relatively at least, from suffering and sorrow, and rid the society of the many evils that it is subject to, nor can we ever reach the perfection of spiritual knowledge. Speaks. There is a beautiful verse in the Mahabharata. It says, you know, how the error occurs. He says, those who think the self to be other than what it is, those who think self to be other than what it is, and act from the basis from that wrong idea, what sin such a man will not commit? And Mahabharata says that such a one acting from the mistaken basis is self-defeased thief, self-deceived thief. Chorena atma apaharina anyatasantam atmanam anyatasantam atmanam anyatha pratipedire kim tena nakritam papam chorena atma apaharina. What a beautiful verse it is. One who acts from a notion of wrong idea of self, then what sin will he not commit? That is the problem today. What is the source of evil today? That is the source of evil. So this is to be sorted out. And how can this be sorted out? When you do only maceration of the senses and organs, and assuming various postures and breathing of the lung breath, does it ever do? Our wrong notions, acting on wrong notions, have corrupted our character. All the wrong tendencies of the mind, like greed and revenge and hatred and attachment to objects of the senses, and laziness, tamasic and rajasic qualities, can they be ever sorted out by physical exercises or just closing your eyes and calling so-called meditations? It can never be. In fact, such practices will bring out more problems. So what we have to do is to take knowledge. And how do we take knowledge? Again, look what the Vishnu Purana says. Mind is the cause of man's bondage as well as his liberation. Mana eva manishanam karanam bandhamokshaya. How does it bind him? Bandhaya vishya sangi. When mind is attached to the enjoyment of the object of the senses, it creates an impression and mind is bound and the soul is bound. Mukthaya nirvishyam manaha. So when you become nirvishaya, that when you work out through discrimination, complete detachment from attachment, objects of sense, enjoyment, then mind becomes purified and leads to liberation. So this is the path. So this path means it is knowledge to be taken first theoretically, philosophically, and then apply it. And as you apply it, gradually the real knowledge begins to arise in us. The real knowledge begins to arise in us. That's why, you know, in all the great disciplines of the true teachers, the two ways of proceeding on the path. First is hearing, and then doing. Shravana and Shamana. Shravana means hearing. Hearing means the study also. Study of the teachings of the two teachers. That means Shravana. Acousticoi, as called it, as Mr. P.P. Wadia teaches in his articles. And then one, after hearing and after understanding and grasping the the real import of the study that we do of spiritual knowledge, it brings about a change in our outlook and begin to act, put them into action. That is our shamana. We begin to act. We put what we understand into action. So there are two kinds of knowledge. This is what Vishnu Purana says. One knowledge arising from the light of knowledge arising from study of the scriptures, reflection and meditation, and change in the whole outlook. When you intellectually grasp the nature of reality, then what we mistook earlier to be reality, and all the wrong kinds of things that we did gradually fall away in this new knowledge. And that is the first step. It is called Agamottam Viveka. Agama means scriptures. Agamottam Viveka. Viveka that comes from study of the scriptures. And the other kind of knowledge that arises is Parabrahma Viveka. So when the true discrimination, light of discrimination, buddhi begins to awaken in us, that leads to higher light, true path. So our first step, our whole purpose is to find the true way, the true path. In the first step in that is study. Without study, nothing can be achieved. So difference between the two is beautifully expressed in the Vishnu Purana. The first one, Agamottam Viveka, that is the discriminative knowledge that arises from the study of the scriptures, is likened to the lamp that we light, which dispels darkness to some extent around us, but it cannot destroy the whole darkness outside. So this is the first step. But the other one, Parabrahma Viveka, that is the buddhi begins to awaken and illuminate the mind. It is like the sun which destroys the whole of darkness. So Agamottam Viveka cha Dvidha Jnanam Tadichyate Shabda Brahma Agamamayam Parabrahma Vivekajam. How beautifully this is put in the Vishnu Purana. And this is precisely what the Bhagavad Gita, the way Krishna leads us to the true knowledge. How nicely this step is followed. In the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna begins to teach about the nature of the true self. In the second chapter, I myself was not, nor thou, nor all the princes of the earth, nor shall we ever hereafter cease to be. The self in the body is never destroyed. It was there before birth. It remains unchanged as witness and gardener of experience of all the experience of the life. And it never perishes. So it experiences the infancy, youth and old age. It will be the same in future incarnations. Self is untouched by works, by desires. So it stands apart. So, but this, all the pain and pleasure, heat and cold that we experience, it pertains to the egotism, its prakriti, not to purusha, the spirit. So this we have to endure, always remembering that self is our true self, our true consciousness, never completely, not even one bit is conquered by this. So we have to take that firm stand in the knowledge of the true self, and then begin to practice what Krishna says, Shravana, in the third chapter of the book, Karma Yoga. All duties you have to perform. When I am not the self though, why should I do this duty? It's a wrong thing. It's a wrong thing. So all duties that comes to you is because you have generated those karmas in the past, it has to burn itself out. It will not burn itself out if you, while performing the duties, become self-interested in the actions that you have to do. If you become self-interested in the actions you have to do, it binds you again and leads you into error. So while performing your duties, detach yourself from the results of action. This is not I. Do the best you know and resign all self-interest in action. And neither attach yourself to any results or any sensation or desire, nor shrink from affright or disgust from anything that you dislike. So remain neutral within, neither disliking or liking. And if you do this there and then, you cut the bonds of karma and gradually become liberated. This is Krishna's teaching. So perform all your actions with this attitude, with this knowledge. This is doing or performing actions according to what we have seen. And what Krishna says is, it is not merely in your area of duty as a personality, is not that. Having said that self is one, illuminates the whole world, so is oneself illuminates all bodies and all interrelated, interconnected. You cannot separate yourself from other beings, and duty is, you owe a great debt of obligation to all other beings, especially to the beings who are dependent upon you, the lower orders of being who are progressively marching to higher life, who go to make and gives you the basis for incarnation, to gain experience for your soul. So you owe a great debt of gratitude, a great debt of duty to them. You owe great duty to your teachers, to your fellow men, to your neighbors. So this duty you have to perform without self-interest. And there and then you burn away the dross of attachment, aversion, and the many defects and vices that develop from this. You there and then clear it off. And the body by reaction, and the heart and the mind become purified. Now this is the reaction, this is the purification of the body. In the yoga of aphorisms, one of the disciplines is purification of body and mind. Can purification of body and mind come from doing asanas and pranayama? It is absurd. It cannot. It comes from right thought, right knowledge, and right action based on that right knowledge. With change of your attitude, change of your whole life's goal, and performance of duty, highest duty to all, without self-interest. So sacrifice to the eternal. This is sacrifice Krishna is speaking of. Now look what he says in the 18th chapter. Yeah. In the very beginning of 18th chapter, he teaches this. Now, deeds of sacrifice, he's talking about the devotees who say the deeds of sacrifice of mortification and charity should not be forsaken. Krishna agrees, yes, it's true. Among these divided opinions, hear my certain decision, O best of Bharatas, upon this matter of disinterested forsaking, which is declared to be of three kinds, O chief of men. Now, Krishna's supreme words, deeds of sacrifice of mortification, tapas, deeds of sacrifice, yajna, of mortification, tapas, and of charity, dana, are not to be abandoned, for they are proper to be performed and are purifiers of the wise. This is what brings about purification of the body, mind, and heart. Jesus said, there's a point in cleaning the outside of the vessel. Clean the inside of the plant. You cannot reach the inside of your self, inside of your mind and soul, with outer. You have to do it with your soul knowledge and soul wisdom, with the help of your discriminating faculty. But even those works are to be performed, Krishna says, after having renounced all self-interest in them and in their fruits. This, O son of Prita, is my ultimate and supreme decision. So this is knowledge which purifies man. Now we have many bias, many vices, formidable force to overcome. It's very difficult to overcome them. Now I'll read one or two portions from the Bhagavad Gita to show how difficult it is. In the first place, how we fall into error by attachment to senses and organs. He says, how our attachment to enjoyment of the object of sense binds us. How clearly he analyzes it. So this is, this is something we have to study this and meditate and put into practice. He says, he who attended to the inclination of the senses, in them hath a concern. From this concern is created passion. From passion, anger. From anger is produced delusion. And from delusion, a loss of memory. Loss of memory of what? Loss of memory of the true self. And loss of memory, loss of discrimination between self and not self. And from loss of discrimination, loss of all. If we lose the memory of what we truly are, and whatever we may gain in the outside, of what use is it? It's a loss of all. But he who, free from attachment or repulsion for objects, if he get attached to any objects, it binds. If he with disgust from anything, then again it binds. So we have to practice that equanimity by which we neither dislike or dislike under all circumstances in our relations with others. Otherwise we bind ourselves, and this leads us to egotism, darkness of mind and sorrows. But he who, free from attachment and repulsion for objects, experiencing them through the senses and organs, with heart obedient to his will, attains to tranquility of thought, and this tranquil state attained therefrom shall soon result a separation from all troubles, and his mind being thus at ease fixed upon one object, it embraces wisdom on all sides. And finally, Krishna says how this practice will lead to mental devotion and mental illumination. He says, one who practices this persistently, not with fits and starts, persistently throughout his life, full of devotion, then Krishna promises, to them thus always devoted to me, who worship me with love, I give that mental devotion by which they come to me. For them do I, out of my compassion, standing within their hearts, destroy the darkness which springs from ignorance by the brilliant lamp of spiritual discernment. And in the seventh chapter, Sri Krishna says that when you are engaged in this practice, even if we make many mistakes, it doesn't matter at all. Mistakes do not matter. What matters is our persistence in doing things and learning from our mistakes, and persistence in this discipline. And when we come to the end of life in this practice, whatever we had practiced, whatever we had learned, whatever we had attained is never destroyed. And Krishna says, a certain sense of certain purification takes place of mind and body and heart. And soul always takes rebirth in such circumstances, in such families, where which conforms to its nature. If the nature has been sufficiently purified, it is attracted to such a situation, circumstance in the next embodied life, where the soul, the man comes again into the knowledge which was his in past, and from there he comes into company with others who strove with him and the teachers, and he begins to work in the direction with greater diligence. And this is persistence, life after life, will bring about such transformation in him, and separation of evil tendencies, and development of noble and divine virtues, and that will lead him to, in some birth, into a family of wise men. So this is how the knowledge, which Krishna says, brings about purification of the self, and through that alone we can forget about liberation, forget about moksha. We can really work for our true happiness. We can really bring about a great change in our surroundings, in our family, in our society, by our action. So this is the meaning of Krishna saying in the Bhagavad Gita, how spiritual knowledge burns to ashes, all actions burn to ashes, and brings to birth spiritual knowledge in us. So let's stop here and take a spot, the remaining 10 minutes. 10 minutes. Thank you.